It was an ordinary school day in Littleton, Colorado on Tuesday, April 20th, 1999. A senior in high school named Brooks Brown thought something was a bit off that day, as one of his classmates and sometimes friend Eric Harris missed morning classes. Before lunch period, Brooks walked outside toward the designated smoking area near the school parking lot. On his way, he runs into Eric, who is wearing a black trench coat and pulling a bulky duffel bag from his car. A sight that struck him as odd, especially because he was parked far from where he was supposed to. Just as Brooks was about to confront him about his absence that day, Eric replied, "It doesn't matter anymore, Brooks. I like you now. Get out of here. Go home." Brooks was confused, but this attitude was nothing new. The boy decided to just shake off what was said and walk away as he carefully weighed his options on whether to skip the next period. Should he go home like his friend suggested, or go back to class later? When he was about a block away from school, he heard something that sounded like fireworks at 11:19 a.m. He thought Eric must have been playing a senior prank. But then the quick succession of pops became faster. It was unmistakably gunfire. Brooks began knocking on doors, panic-stricken, trying to find a phone. Within just 1 hour, 18-year-old Eric Harris and partner 17-year-old Dylan Klebold murdered 12 students and one teacher before ending their own lives. At the time, the Columbine Massacre was the deadliest school shooting in American history, one in which many copycats tried to outdo. Ever since the tragedy, the public accepted the idea that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold were outcasts who were incessantly bullied until they were driven over the edge. This explanation is what inspired the anti-bullying campaign and sparked debates over violence in films, shows, and music. However, the real explanation for that day is anything but simple. Welcome to another episode of Crimson Sin with Tamsin Lee. I am your host, Tamsin Lee. Full show notes and sources can be found in the description. Today's case was a request from a listener, which I appreciate very much. To be honest, I am a bit nervous to broach such a heavy topic, but the Columbine High School Massacre is an incident that brought many concerns to light. In this episode, I will discuss the perpetrators, honor the victims, and discuss the controversies these two monsters brought to the public eye. I also want to state that I in no way condone any of the acts these two people carried out. This information I am providing is for historical and informational purposes only. With that said, let's take a look at the perpetrators. Dylan Klebold was born on September 11, 1981 in Lakewood, Colorado. A defining characteristic of Dylan was his shyness. Many reported how painfully shy the boy was during his early school years. He was also an exceptionally bright child, as he was part of the Colorado Challenging High Intellectual Potential Students program in third grade. His friend Brooks Brown was also a part of this program. However, he left within a year due to the competitive attitude among the students and the lack of support from teachers. Something that Dylan most likely felt as well, but he continued in the program until he aged out in sixth grade. This action was not unlike Dylan, because he wasn't one to let others know how he was feeling. He was known to bottle up his emotions until he blew up in rages. Dylan Klebold was known to play t-ball, baseball, and soccer in his earlier school years. He was also in the Cub Scouts. Eric Harris was born on April 9th, 1981 in Wichita, Kansas. His parents were natives of Colorado, but his father was a United States Air Force pilot, which had the family frequently moving. The family would move to Dayton, Ohio in 1983, and then to Oscoda, Michigan in 1989. Eric was fascinated by war stories by this time, and would regularly play soldier with his older brother and the neighborhood children. Nothing unusual for a boy his age. The family would move again to Plattsburgh, New York in 1991. While attending Stafford Middle School, Eric played Little League Baseball. He also regularly attended birthday parties and was part of the crowd. Many who knew him at the time described him as a normal kid. The following year, his father retired from the military and the family moved to Littleton, Colorado. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold met in seventh grade at Ken Carl Middle School, but did not become inseparable until high school. Over time, they became increasingly close, hanging out by often going out bowling, carpooling, and playing the video game Doom over a private server connected to their personal computers. Chad Lachlan, a close friend of Harris and Klebold, said that they always sat alone together at lunch and often kept to themselves. Some accounts suggest the two were victims of bullying, but there are more accounts showing they were fairly popular with a sizable group of friends. During his school career, Eric had many friends. He was even on the Columbine soccer team for his freshman and sophomore year, where his teammates recounted that he was a great player who enjoyed the sport a lot. While in his freshman year, Eric met a girl named Tiffany Teifer in German class. They liked each other and also attended homecoming. For an undisclosed reason, Tiffany was no longer interested in Eric and broke things off with him. In response to her rejection, he faked a suicide, sprawling on the ground with fake blood splashed all over him. When Tiffany found him laying on the ground, she began screaming for help. Eric and his friends began laughing, enraging Tiffany, who told him he needed to get psychological help as she stormed off. Eric, Dylan, and Brooks Brown bonded over their shared common interest in philosophy and video games. The three also joined the theater department. Dylan worked backstage as a soundboard operator. Eric and Dylan were active in school play productions, operated video productions, and became computer assistants, maintaining the school's computer server. The three would regularly attend football games, watching Eric's older brother play as he was the starting kicker of the Columbine High School football team, the Rebels, a connection that undoubtedly served Eric with more popularity among his peers. Just like at any school, bullying was fairly common at Columbine High School. And just as equally unsurprising, teachers allegedly did little to stop it. A junior who was frequently bullied named Eric Dutroux had his parents buy him a black duster jacket for a Halloween costume in 1996. The costume plan fell through, but he enjoyed the trench coat and liked the attention it gave him. Before long, his friends started to wear them too, regardless of how hot it was outside. When someone mentioned they looked like a trench coat mafia, their group's name was coined. This factoid may sound unrelated, but it does come back around. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold were not a part of this clique. Most of the kids in this group had graduated by 1999, but their friend Chris Morris was a part of the trench coat mafia. was a part of the Trenchcoat Mafia. Chris had a part-time job at the Blackjack Pizza restaurant and helped Eric get a job there during the summer of his sophomore year. Not long after Eric was hired, Dylan found a job at the same restaurant. Eric was described as a good employee. He was always punctual, he was polite, and he was described as well put together at work. His good reputation led him to become shift manager at the pizzeria during his senior year, where he would use this position to win over girls with free slices. When the restaurant was slow, the boys and their co-workers would horse around by drinking beer and shooting bottle rockets off the roof. It appears that at this time when Eric and Dylan were working at the restaurant, their deadly bond took form. It is also when their behavior seemed to have changed. Eric reportedly became bolder and stranger, a trait that Dylan, an impressionable follower-type character, mirrored. Brooks recalled playing a video game with his friend at 3 a.m. one night, when they heard a tap at the window. It was Eric and Dylan, dressed all in black, sitting in a tree. When Brooks let his friends inside, the two explained they were running missions. These missions consisted in the pair toilet papering houses, spray painting graffiti, and setting fire to potted plants. Sometimes the acts were in retaliation for something the pair perceived as slights at school, but for the most part, it was something to pass the time. However, as time went on, Brooks noticed that these missions Eric and Dylan were carrying out started to become cruel. Eric and Dylan reportedly bragged about shooting trick-or-treaters with a BB gun during Halloween in 1997. That same year, Dylan was suspended from school for carving homophobic insults into a freshman boy's locker. During this time, it was reported that Eric started pushing people away. However, he was not able to drive yet and had to rely on his friend Brooks Brown for rides to and from school. This was not a good combination, as Eric was described as punctual and Brooks was always running late. The two butted heads over this until one day in winter, Brooks told him he would never give him a ride again. So now, Eric had to ride the bus to school, and it wasn't something that he was just going to let go. A few days after the argument, Brooks was stopped at a stop sign near Eric's bus stop. When Eric threw a block of ice at his windshield, shattering it, Brooks not only told his parents what happened, but went to Eric's parents and told them about everything. His missions, him drinking, and just everything. As you can imagine, this deeply angered the teenager. That January, Dylan would hand Brooks a piece of paper with a web address on it, telling him, "I think you should look at this tonight, and you cannot tell Eric I gave it to you." The website contained Eric's AOL profile, his alias being Reb, or sometimes Reb Doomer, where he described his various acts of vandalism with his friend Vodka, which was Dylan's username. It did not only detail these missions, but also included his pastime of building pipe bombs and his desire to kill people. And at that time, he named Brooks Brown as one of the people he wanted to kill. Brooks's parents called the authorities. The detective the parents spoke to noted that they had found pipe bombs in the area and believed the threats were credible enough to file a formal report. A few days after this, Eric and Dylan missed school, with rumors swirling that they were in some serious trouble. Brooks and his family believed that they had taken care of the problem. However, while the Brown family believed the pair were arrested for the threat against Brooks' life, they had actually been arrested for something completely different. On January 30th, 1998, Eric and Dylan had broke into a locked van to steal computers and other electronic equipment. The boys were parked at a park entrance further down the road when a Jefferson County Sheriff's officer pulled up. Because the park was closed by that time of night, the officer thought the situation was suspicious and decided to investigate. When he asked about the equipment they were moving, Eric immediately admitted they had stolen it. The two were charged with mischief, breaking and entering, trespassing, and theft. Both boys left a good impression on the juvenile officers, who offered to expunge their criminal record if they agreed to attend a diversionary program. This program would include them having community service and psychiatric treatment. Eric was required to attend anger management classes, where he surprisingly made a great impression. The boys appeared to be making leaps and bounds, with their probation officer discharging them early for good behavior. It was stated that Eric was a very bright individual who was likely to succeed in life, while Dylan was said to be intelligent, but needs to understand that hard work is part of fulfilling a dream. Both Eric and Dylan were deemed rehabilitated and given clean records. If the judge, over their case, would have seen the Browns' formal report, or if the search warrant would have been executed from this report, Eric would not have been in this program with his charges expunged. He would have been jailed for the van theft, and authorities would have discovered his pipe bombs. But for some reason, this formal report was not given to the judge, and the search warrant for the Harris' household was left unsigned. On April 30th, Eric handed over a letter of apology he wrote to the owner of the van. In the letter, Eric expressed his regret over his actions. However, he felt anything but remorse for his actions. In a journal entry dated April 12th, Eric wrote, "Isn't America supposed to be the land of the free? How come if I'm free, I can't deprive some fucking dumb shit from his possessions if he leaves them sitting in the front seat of his fucking van in plain sight, in the middle of fucking nowhere, on a fry fucking day night? Natural selection, fucker should be shot." Eric Harris was described as charismatic as well as nice and likable, something that could obviously be seen from these actions. He would often brag about deceiving others and his ability to make anyone believe anything. While he presented himself as a model program participant, deep down, he was very angry and embarrassed that he was caught. A feeling that was shared by Dylan. By that spring, they were planning their Judgment Day, or NBK. NBK was shorthand for the movie Natural Born Killers, which has been a controversial film since its release in 1994, because apparently it gives many young viewers the bright idea to carry out murderous sprees. I've never seen it, so I don't know. I read the synopsis and don't understand the appeal, so I can't comment on that. But there have been a fair few murders committed by young people claiming their inspiration was from that movie. While Eric showed more troubling signs, Dylan was starting to show equally concerning signs in his journal writings. It is not unusual for a teenager to feel lost, especially when it comes to religion and God. But Dylan started drinking alcohol as a means to self-medicate. He also turned to self-harm and had thoughts of suicide. While he talked about violence, he talked about love way more often, both as an abstract concept and personally. His journal even contained two notes to a girl he had a crush on, which he never delivered. The consistent theme in his journal was that he thought he ruined his life and no one understood him. Dylan would call other people zombies who were lucky because ignorance is bliss. Eric's journals were more single-minded, referring to people as robots who were conned into following a false social order. He also claimed that he and Dylan were the only ones with self-awareness. He believed other people didn't think for themselves and would never survive a doom test. He was fixated on the idea of natural selection, which was written on his shirt the day of the massacre. Eric's writings were unhinged. He hated human beings, loved Nazis, and wanted to kill mankind. His dark and violent fantasies furthered in a 1998 journal entry, where he stated, "I want to grab some weak little freshmen and just tear them apart like a fucking wolf. Show them who is God." An employee of the FBI named Duane Fusilier presented his belief to a conference of psychologists that were based on Eric's homicidal fantasies, skill at lying, and lack of remorse. He believed Eric Harris was a budding young psychopath. However, numerous psychologists believed he was a full-blown psychopath. In the year leading up to the Columbine shooting, Eric built dozens of explosives, including pipe bombs and crickets, which were made from CO2 canisters. He was planning something big, and even looked into making napalm. At one point during this time, he tried to recruit his friend Chris Morris to help in creating these explosives. When he refused, Eric played off his request as a joke. Eric began taking notes about student movements and the number of exits in the school. While researching the Brady Bill and loopholes in gun laws, on November 22, 1998, Eric and Dylan convinced an 18-year-old mutual friend, whom Dylan later brought to prom days before the shooting, to buy two shotguns and a high-carbine rifle for them at a gun show. After they illegally acquired these weapons, Dylan sawed off his Savage 311D 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun, shortening the overall length to approximately 23 inches. As Eric did the same to his Savage Springfield 12-gauge pump shotgun, sawing his off at around 26 inches. Later, Dylan bought a 9mm TEC DC-9 pistol, which is a semi-automatic pistol which he bought from another friend behind the pizza shop. Apparently for Eric, after the two made the gun purchases, they had crossed the point of no return. Still, even in this, there were blatant signs that everyone missed. Just before New Year, the local gun shop called the Harris household to inform Eric the high-capacity magazines he'd ordered for his rifle had arrived. But his father was the one who answered the phone. Eric had told his father that it was just a wrong number. Dylan's mental state became worse also, as many times before the attack, he wrote of his plans of taking his life. Some plans were very graphic. One in which he contemplated stealing one of Eric's pipe bombs and strapping it to his neck. Several of these entries were signed goodbye, as if he planned on them being his last. His last threat against his life was dated on August 10th, 1998. It is unknown what happened between this date and April 20th, 1999, but it is known that he fully committed to the whole Judgment Day NBK plan. One of his last entries read, "I'm stuck in humanity. Maybe going NBK with Eric is the way to break free. I hate this." The next to last page in Dylan's journal was written 5 days before the massacre and ends with, "Time to die, time to be free, time to love." Friday, April 16th, 1999, was Eric's and Dylan's last shift at Blackjack Pizza, with Eric securing advances for both of them to purchase last-minute supplies. The next night, Dylan attended prom with Robin Anderson, who was the girl that he enlisted help from attaining guns at the gun show. So he went to prom with her and a group of 12 friends. While Dylan went to prom, Eric went on a first and last date with a girl he had recently met. April 19th, 1999 was the original date of the Columbine attack. However, Eric postponed the plan so he could buy more bullets from a friend. But apparently it slipped his mind that he had turned 18 on the 9th and could legally purchase bullets himself. April 20th, the boys got up, leaving their houses by 5:30 a.m. to begin their final preparations. At 11:10 a.m., Eric arrives at the student parking lot, parking in a spot assigned to another student, while Dylan also arrives, parking in another student space. The choice of parking gave them vantage points of the school's cafeteria and the exits and entrances of the lower level. From everything we know about the Columbine Massacre, it showcases a school shooting. However, from Eric and Dylan's journal entries, it was not supposed to be a shooting. It was supposed to be a bombing. A bombing that, if carried out properly, could have easily killed 600 people. The duffel bag Eric was carrying that day when Brooks Brown confronted him actually contained one of the two propane tank time bombs. After briefly telling Brooks to leave the campus at roughly 11:14 a.m., Eric and Dylan walked into the cafeteria with the propane tank bombs in duffel bags, placing them between two lunch tables. They then walked back out and waited in their cars. The timer for these were meant to go off at 11:17 a.m., when Eric believed the cafeteria would have the most students. The bombs placed in the cafeteria were meant to bring the ceiling of the building down. After the explosion, they would sit in their cars, shooting at students who attempted to flee. But their choice of parking was not only due to their visibility of the entrances and exits. The added purpose for parking in these spots was because Eric and Dylan rigged the vehicles to explode when police, ambulances, and journalists arrived. They had another bomb placed in a park 3 miles from the school, which was set to go off before the others. A decoy bomb, which went off and was reported at 11:19 a.m., drawing authorities away from the school. The pair's initial plan was also to die by suicide by cop. This was the plan, but it didn't turn out that way. What everyone knows to have happened is quite different. The propane bombs were so much bigger than any of the other bombs and weren't easily concealable, so they couldn't hide them at home. Instead, the perpetrators would have to construct them on the morning of the attack. They had no idea how to wire detonators and failed to figure it out before their plans were put into action. Luckily, these bombs never went off. With this failure, experts noticed that the boys' actions took on a new significance. It appears after the bombs didn't go off in the cafeteria, Dylan started having second thoughts about their actions. Initially, they were supposed to stand yards away from each other, but when the shooting started, they were standing together in the spot Dylan was originally supposed to be at. It appeared to many who studied the footage and experts that Dylan had to be convinced to go through with the attack by Eric. And even at that, Eric was the one who did most of the shooting. At 11:19 a.m., the witness hears one of the suspects say, "Go, go!" Eric and Dylan then pull their shotguns out of their bags. They already have 9mm semi-automatic weapons hidden under their black trench coats. From their position at the top of the steps, they begin shooting at students in the area. The first gunshots fired toward the west doors kill Rachel Scott and injure Richard Castaldo, who were sitting on the grass eating their lunch outside the school's west upper entrance near the north side of the library. Students Daniel Rohrbaugh, Sean Graves, and Lance Kirkland just exited a side door of the school cafeteria on their way to the smoker's pit at Clement Park when they were hit by gunfire. All three fall to the ground. Five students sitting on the grass to the west of the stairs are shot at as they begin to run. Michael Johnson suffers gunshot wounds, but is able to reach the outdoor athletic storage shed where he takes cover with others. Mark Taylor suffers a debilitating gunshot wound and falls to the ground, unable to flee with the others. Dylan goes back down the stairs to the area outside the cafeteria and shoots Daniel Rohrbaugh again at close range, killing him. He also shoots Lance Kirkland again, this time at close range, but Lance survives. Dylan briefly entered the side entrance to the cafeteria and stands just inside the doorway, perhaps to figure out why the propane bombs have not exploded. But then he goes back outside and joins Eric at the top of the outside stairs. Eric shoots down the stairs, hitting a student who is shot multiple times as she stands to run for cover into the cafeteria. Witnesses also heard one of the gunmen shout, "This is what we always wanted to do. This is awesome." From the beginning at approximately 11:19 a.m. to 11:23 a.m., both Eric and Dylan were seen lighting and throwing explosive devices onto the roof, into the parking lot, and toward the grassy hillside. Between 11:21 a.m. and 11:23 a.m., authorities started receiving calls of the shooting at the high school. Several of the school's custodial staff and faculty, including teacher William Dave Sanders, were attempting to find out what was happening outside. When they realized the danger, Sanders and school custodians John Curtis and Jay Galantine enter the cafeteria and direct students to get down. Students begin to hide under the cafeteria table. Teacher Patricia Nielsen was working as a hall monitor when she heard a commotion outside. She looks outside, seeing two male students with what she thought were toy guns. She assumed that a school video production was being taped. She was about to go outside to tell the boys to knock it off when one of them fired into the west entrance, causing glass and metal fragments to spray into the hallway. Nielsen suffered abrasions to her shoulder, forearm, and knee from the fragments. Beside Nielsen was a student named Brian Anderson. Brian had been told by a teacher to get out of the school because of the explosions and commotion. Not realizing where the danger was, he exits through the first set of west doors and is caught between the interior and exterior doors when Harris fires at the doors in front of him, shattering the glass. Brian suffered wounds to his chest from the glass fragments. Despite their injuries, Patty Nielsen and Brian are able to flee into the school library, while Harris and Klebold are distracted by the arrival of Deputy Gardner. Gardner has just pulled up in the lower south parking lot of the school, with the lights on his patrol car flashing and the siren sounding. Eric Harris turns his attention from shooting into the west doors of the high school to the student parking lot and to the deputy. Harris fires about 10 shots at the deputy with his rifle before his weapon jams. Gardner fires 4 shots at Harris. At first he thought he hit him, but seconds later Harris begins shooting again at the deputy. Harris then turns and enters the school through the west doors. Students in the cafeteria realize the activity occurring outside is more serious than a senior prank. Students can be seen on the school surveillance videotape escaping up the stairs from the cafeteria to the second level. Several students recalled Sanders directing them to safety by telling them to go down the hallway to the east side exits of the school. At 11:25, Patty Nielsen, hiding under the front counter in the school library, calls 911 to report shots being fired outside the library and smoke entering inside. Student witnesses who entered the north main hallway from the adjoining classrooms see Klebold and Harris standing just inside the school's northwest entry doors. Witnesses see Klebold fire a semi-automatic weapon east towards the students in the main hallway and south down the library hallway. They also hear bullets hitting lockers and other objects all in the hallway as students were running to take cover. A student in the gym observed Klebold and Harris walking east down the north hallway, both just firing their weapons and laughing. Klebold is last seen running back down the north hall to the west in the direction of the library hallway. Teacher Dave Sanders, still on the second floor, turns into the library hallway toward the west entrance in the sounds of gunfire. As Sanders passes the entrance to the library, he apparently sees a gunman cornering toward him from the north hallway. Sanders turns around and heads back the way he had just come. Just before turning the corner to go east, he is shot. Sanders is able to crawl to the corner of the science hallway, where another teacher helps him down into the science classroom. A group of students, including 2 Eagle Scouts, gather around him, attending to his injuries and administering first aid. Harris and Klebold walk up and down the library hallway, randomly shooting but not injuring anyone. Patty Nielsen is still hiding under the front counter just inside the library entrance, continuing her phone call with the Jefferson County dispatcher. Nielsen reacts to the sounds of gunshots and explosions coming from the hallway outside the library, but she would remain short little conversations with the dispatcher. She screams at the students in the library to get under the table, stay hidden, don't go anywhere, stay down. Then she reports that a gunman is just outside the library entrance. And I listened to the audio of this call, and you could not understand a thing she was saying with all of the explosions and gunfire in the background. At about 30 minutes into the attack, Eric and Dylan were in the library with upwards of 50 people. It was speculated that the pair targeted athletes and Christians. But to be honest, it did not really seem like there was a designated target. Things appeared to take a turn when, after killing one student in the library, Eric's shotgun recoiled into his face, breaking his nose. After claiming the lives of 10 students in the library, the boys left. This is when over 30 of the 50 hostages in the library escaped. Security cameras then show Eric and Dylan going into the cafeteria, trying to set off the propane tanks with pipe bombs and shotgun blasts. The pair then provoked officers by firing through the windows. But the entire time, authorities never entered the building. The two then went back to the library at about 12 p.m. It is speculated that they were waiting to see their car bombs explode, but they never did. This is when they picked a spot and killed themselves at 12:08 p.m. Their grand plan was a complete and total failure. For Eric and Dylan, it was a failure from the start, as it was originally supposed to happen on April 19th, the anniversary of the Waco siege and the Oklahoma City bombing. Eric fantasized about planting bombs all around Littleton and Denver, wanting to create complete and total mayhem. While their initial plans were unsuccessful, the two mass murderers still caused a tragedy that lives on in terror to this day. From what has been uncovered through looking through Eric Harris's writings, is that he did not see himself as a good kid, pushed toward violence. He was infatuated with war and Nazis. He made it clear that he wanted nothing more in life than to be a domestic terrorist in his journal entries. On April 21st, 1998, he wrote, "School is society's way of turning all the young people into good little robots and factory workers. I will sooner die than betray my own thoughts. But before I leave this worthless place, I will kill whoever I deem unfit for anything at all, especially life." This is why his targets at school were random. He wasn't attacking a specific group of people. It's more than reasonable to believe he experienced bullying, but from evidence from his and Dylan's writings, this isn't what caused this tragedy. A lot of the misleading information about what happened that day came from journalists and reporters who were interviewing traumatized teenagers as the events unfolded, and of whom either had no idea what was going on, were going off of hearsay, or were making speculations regarding rumors. Most of these students didn't know the killers. I'm not discrediting their accounts of what happened that day, but what I am saying is that they were still in a frazzled state of mind when interviewers were bombarding them for answers. These teenagers didn't have time to fully digest the situation themselves or feel safe before the media started demanding answers. Another problem that day was the police. It is stated that the Jefferson County Sheriff didn't know how to handle the situation. During the entire ordeal, police never called in the SWAT team for help. They never attempted to go inside the building. Nothing. Officers held the perimeter until after the killers committed suicide. But one thing that no one wanted getting out was the fact that authorities had been warned about Eric Harris. Brooks Brown and his family had already raised alarms about the kid before the shooting. There was a search warrant and everything. Columbine could have been prevented entirely. This caused a public outcry, obviously, one that needed to be immediately squashed. On TV, the sheriff labeled Brooks Brown as an accomplice to the shooting. The victims' families fought in Colorado courts to have documents released and failed. The police report on Eric Harris mysteriously vanished. Everything that happened and what caused the Columbine High School massacre was not released until 2006. But by this time, everyone moved on, as other tragedies had happened since. To this day, many believe that if Eric Harris had not been bullied, then he wouldn't have been sent over the edge. But from the evidence collected and statements from the FBI, bullying was not the case. Columbine could have been prevented if authorities would have followed through with the pipe bomb search warrant and the threats made against his friend's life. Equally upsetting is how the 24 injured and 13 deceased victims were treated moments just before and after their deaths. The first victim of the Columbine shooting was 17-year-old Rachel Scott. She was eating lunch on the grass near the west entrance with her friend Richard Castaldo. She was a junior at Columbine High School and described as highly loved and valued by many. Rachel was in theater and had actually been friends with Dylan since kindergarten. She played the lead in a student-written school play called The Smoke in the Room and was writing a play for her senior year. She also liked photography and was active in the Celebration Christian Fellowship Church. She was made for the camera, according to her father, and was an aspiring writer and actress. Her family didn't know for sure that she was dead until 2 days later on Thursday, when her name was on the list of the confirmed deceased. Of course, by this point, they all knew the worst was coming. Throughout her life, Rachel was spiritual, often writing to God in her diaries about wanting to reach the unreached. After her death, Rachel's car became a memorial by her friends, where it sat in the parking lot. One of her friends stated, "In my eyes, she was just one of those kinds of people you know you won't ever meet again. She was the kind of person only born once." Rachel Scott was buried at Chapel Hill Memorial Gardens in the Columbine Memorial Garden. The next victim was 15-year-old Daniel Rohrbaugh. He had been walking from the cafeteria with his two friends, Lance Kirkland and Sean Graves, before he was shot by the killers. When Daniel was shot, there was no warning, nothing leading up to that moment. As he walked, he fell after receiving blows to the abdomen and left leg. His friend Lance tried to catch him, but was shot also. It was stated that Dylan Klebold shot him again at point-blank range in the chest. However, according to forensic analysis, the fatal shot received was by Eric. Regardless, this is where Daniel was left to bleed out. Daniel loved electronics and computer games. At the time of his death, he was looking forward to getting his driver's permit soon. He is remembered by his friends as a fun guy. Every day after school, he would help his father at his stereo business, and during the summer, he worked on his grandfather's farm in Kansas, harvesting wheat. He would save up the money he earned from helping his father and grandfather to buy Christmas presents for his family. Daniel and Rachel were the two victims shot and killed outside the school, and their bodies remained on the lawn and on the sidewalk, uncovered, for 2 days, before paramedics came to move them. Students and faculty who were fleeing the building had to walk past Daniel and Rachel's lifeless bodies to get to safety. Shortly after learning of his death, Dan's mother, Sue, started a load of laundry in order to do something normal and came across Daniel's shirt and socks. She stated, "The little things just bring back the horror of the fact that he's not with us anymore." She didn't often see Dan in the mornings before his death, but that last morning they managed to come together for a brief chat that ended with a hug, a kiss, her telling him she loved him. It was the last time she saw him alive. Dan's funeral was held at Grace Presbyterian Church, and he was buried in Littleton Cemetery in Littleton, Colorado. The third victim of the attack was a coach and a computer and business teacher of Columbine. 47-year-old Dave Sanders, the only teacher murdered during the shooting. He was married with 4 children and had 5 grandchildren. His acts of heroism and courage during that day will never be forgotten. As soon as he heard the gunshots outside, Dave Sanders sprung into action, running to the cafeteria to tell the students to evacuate. Along with the help of 2 janitors, they evacuated hundreds of students before he ran upstairs to tell the kids in the classrooms to hide. While he was upstairs, he was shot in the head, torso, and neck by Eric. But he managed to crawl into the science lab where he bled to death, waiting for help that was promised to come. Students in the science lab tried to keep the teacher alive by showing him photos of his family and wrapping clothes closely on his wounds to keep him from bleeding out. One student even wrote on a whiteboard, "One bleeding to death," and put it in the window. But the message was dismissed by law enforcement and officials who thought it was just a bogus claim made by the killers. Dave's daughter Angela said at his funeral, "What you did in that school on Tuesday was an amazing act of heroism. Even after you were hurt, you continue to be the brave, selfless man we all know you are." Dave was buried in Littleton's Chapel Hill Memorial Gardens. Since his death, Coach Dave Sanders has had a softball field at Columbine and a scholarship named after him to honor his memory, and received the Arthur Ashe Award for Courage. The fourth victim of Eric and Dylan was 16-year-old Kyle Velasquez. Relatives and neighbors say Kyle Velasquez enjoyed chores and family activities. They say he was a gentle giant. He was a sophomore that was 6 feet tall and 230 pounds when he died. But those who knew him knew that he was a little boy at heart. Affectionate and sincere, he loved nothing more than helping his dad around the house, putting up shelves, mowing the lawn, washing the car. Every day, he would kiss his mom on the cheek and tell her that he loved her. He dreamed of joining the Navy like his dad or becoming a firefighter. When Kyle was just a baby, he suffered a stroke that left him mentally disabled, and he also had severe asthma. As a special needs child, Kyle was often ignored, avoided, and teased. Due to his disabilities, Kyle's parents had prepared to spend the rest of their lives with him. He would accompany his mother everywhere while she ran her errands. Kyle had only been attending Columbine for 3 months and was just beginning to come out of his shell when the massacre occurred. He loved computers and was sitting at one of the computer tables in Columbine's library when the killers came in. It is said that he may have been too confused or frightened by the chaos and noise to hide himself. Dylan Klebold shot him in the back and the head. Kyle was the first victim to die in the library. Kyle was buried with military honors in Fort Logan National Cemetery in Denver, Colorado, since his father was a Navy veteran. His parents were given the flags from his coffin and the one that was flown at half-mast in Kyle's honor at the state capitol. The youngest victim was 14-year-old Steve Curno. Steve Curno was a freshman at Columbine who dreamed of becoming a Navy Top Gun pilot and was very close with his mom Susan and father Robert. Steve loved soccer. When he discovered his soccer skills weren't strong enough to make the team at Columbine, he continued to referee part-time and play on the team his father coached. Steve was hiding under one of the small computer tables in the library when the shooting began. Eric Harris shot Steve in the neck with a sawed-off shotgun. Steve died in the library. His funeral was held at Trinity Christian Center. His mom wrote a note to Steve that was read at his funeral. "Thank you for that special moment 2 weeks ago when you said, 'Mom, I bet there aren't many guys who can discuss things with their mom like we do.'" Steve was buried in Fort Logan National Cemetery in Denver, Colorado. The next victim was 17-year-old Cassie Bernal. Cassie was a junior at Columbine. Her parents, Misty and Brad, called her Bunny Rabbit and said she loved to go rock climbing in Breckenridge. She had a rough time during her teenage angst years, but was finally getting past it. Cassie made new friends and she found support at her church where her parents had insisted she attend youth programs. She found her way back to religion after attending a church summer camp in 1997, where she became a born-again Christian. Cassie is one of the victims who was claimed to have been asked if she believed in God by the gunman. Accounts of that dispute the stating that another girl was given that question. However, whether the question was for Cassie or not, she became the focal point for church groups and left a legacy on the world as one of the girls that defended her faith to the very end. According to witness accounts, Cassie was in the library with her friends when teacher Patty Nelson entered the library and told everyone to get down. Cassie had her hands over her face, most likely so she wouldn't see what was happening. Just after killing Steve Curno, Eric Harris went to the table where Cassie and freshman Emily Wyant were hiding. He slapped the top of the table and said to the two frightened girls, "Peekaboo!" He then bent down, pointed his sawed-off shotgun under the table, and fired once, shooting Cassie in the right side of the head. She died immediately. The next victim was 16-year-old Matthew Ketcher. Matthew was an athlete, but he put his academics above everything else. Matt was in the library studying when the shooting began. He had been seated at a table with his friend Craig Scott, who was the brother of victim Rachel Scott. When the teacher came in to tell them to hide, 18-year-old Isaiah Scholes hid under the table with the boys. Isaiah was a friend and fellow athlete of Matthew's. After the shooters entered the library, they shot several people before Dylan Klebold spotted Isaiah and called Eric Harris's attention to their table. The two gunmen made racial slurs toward Isaiah, a black boy, and then Harris shot him at close range. Klebold fired on Matt next, hitting him in the chest. Matt died sometime later in the library, where he lay. The University of Colorado, where Matt had planned to attend, sent his younger brother Adam one of their jerseys bearing Matt's name and the jersey number he wore as part of Columbine's football team. Matt was buried in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. In September of 1999, Matt Ketcher was posthumously accepted into the National Honor Society. Isaiah was a comedian and athlete, very popular amongst his peers, and the principal distinguished Isaiah as a great loss to the community following the massacre. He wanted to be a comedian, dreamed of becoming a music executive. After graduating, he wanted to attend an arts college. He was born with a heart defect. His parents said he was a fighter who overcame his disability and went on to play football and wrestle. Isaiah also played keyboards and wanted to become a record producer. His brother Anthony was a freshman at Columbine and was outside with a friend when the shooting started. He was able to get to safety by running through the school and out the other side. 18-year-old Lauren Townsend was the next victim of the massacre. Lauren was a senior and captain of the girls' varsity volleyball team. She was a member of the National Honor Society and was a candidate for valedictorian of her graduating class. Lauren was a talented sketch artist as well. Nicknamed Lulu, she was a straight-A student. She volunteered at a local animal shelter and had planned to major in biology at Colorado State University when she graduated from Columbine. Lauren was in the library with her friends when the shooting began. She hid beneath the table with them when the teacher told everyone to get down, finding herself beside a frightened Val Schnurr. Lauren put her arm around her, drew her closer, and told her everything would be okay. After several minutes of hearing the gunman taunt and shoot other people hiding in the library, Dylan Klebold came to Lauren's table. He opened fire, injuring Lisa and Val. He fired again, as fast as his weapon would shoot, hitting Lauren several times. A few minutes later, Eric came back around the table and shot beneath it again, hitting Lauren's already dead body. She died on the floor of the library from multiple wounds to the head, chest, and lower body. Her funeral was held at Foothills Bible Church, where her brother Josh played a tribute video filled with moments from her life. Many of her teachers spoke at her funeral, commending her gentle nature and loving spirit, as well as her academic excellence. Her coffin was white, which allowed people attending her funeral to write on it. Her father wrote, "Lulu, you'll always be my baby." She was buried in Littleton Cemetery in Littleton, Colorado. 16-year-old John Tomlin was a sophomore at Columbine, a native of Wisconsin. His family moved to Littleton in 1995 when his father got a job with a heating firm. John found the move difficult at first and was shy and lonely, but he soon made friends. He attended the Foothills Bible Church and belonged to the Riverside Baptist Church South Youth Group, where he met his girlfriend of 7 months. He loved church and Chevrolet trucks. He had recently got his driver's license and had just bought an old Chevy pickup that he had been working for since he was 14. He enjoyed off-roading Rocky Mountains and once drove all the way to Mexico to help build a house for a poor family. He was gentle and kind. Family and friends remember his energy and the warmth of his smile. His mother recalled he had a great sense of humor. He was always making goofy faces. John Tomlin was studying in the library when the killers entered and hid under his table with Nicole Nolan. Both were shot by Eric, but both were still alive. Dylan shot John a second time, point blank, instantly killing him. Nicole survived, and it's believed she only survived because she pretended she was dead. 16-year-old Kelly Fleming and her family moved to Littleton from Phoenix, Arizona, 18 months before the shooting. Her father, Don, said they scoured the area looking for a good neighborhood where their daughters would be safe. Kelly was a shy and creative girl who loved Halloween and was an aspiring songwriter and author who wrote many poems and short stories based on her life experiences. She had been writing an autobiography on her home computer. She started it with the moment her mother's water broke and had gotten as far as her 5th year. She regularly went to Columbine's library to write. Her stories often had happy endings. Kelly was learning to drive and wanted to get a job at a daycare center and save enough money to buy a Mustang or a Corvette. She longed to be able to drive so she could return to Phoenix for a visit or go on road trips. She loved to read, especially books about vampires. One day she hoped to be a published author. She entered many writing contests. When the shooters entered the library, Kelly was hiding beside a table with other girls who she had been sitting with. At one point, Dylan Klebold fired under the table, injuring Val and Lisa, who she was sitting with. He fired his gun again, killing Lauren. Both gunmen reloaded their weapons and taunted Val, asking her if she believed in God. The shooters then moved away from Kelly's table, moving to another table where they shot Nicole Nolan and killed John Tomlin, before moving back to the girls' table. Kelly was crouched down out in the open, as there was nowhere else for her to hide. Eric shot her in the back with his sawed-off shotgun. Her body was found on the floor near that of Lauren Townsend. Kelly's father said, "Here's one of the real leaders of the school, and R. Kelly was next to someone like that. I'm sure Lauren took care of Kelly. She wasn't alone." He also said he prayed for the parents of the shooters. "They'll have a tougher time getting over this than we will." 15-year-old Daniel Mauser was an extremely smart, straight-A student in math and science, and never backed down from a challenge. He was shy, but participated on the debate team and even challenged his athletic ability on the cross-country team. He was very active in the community, just like his parents. Daniel was in the library when he was shot in the face by Eric Harris while hiding under one of the tables. Daniel died under the table where he had hidden. His funeral was held jointly with Kelly Fleming's at St. Francis Cabrini Catholic Church. She was buried with two teddy bears in her arms. Kelly Fleming's and Daniel Mauser's graves are both located at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Not long after the shootings, Daniel's family, along with several other families of the shooting victims, learned that the school district was planning to reopen the library where Daniel and all the others had died. The plan was to make cosmetic changes such as removing the carpet, repainting, replacing bullet-riddled shelves, just putting a band-aid over the damaged areas. Upset by this notion, the Mausers, along with several other parents and volunteers, founded HOPE, Healing of People Everywhere, and together they convinced the district to tear out the old library and replace it. The last victim was 17-year-old Corey DePooter. He was a former wrestler who loved to hike, golf, hunt, and fish. He loved wrestling, golf, inline skating. Fishing was his passion. He had recently taken a maintenance job at a golf club to save up money to buy a fishing boat with a friend. Someone Corey used to fish with said it was the times we didn't do well that his personality really shined. Another friend said of him, "When you're going fishing or camping, I know he's going to be there watching and making sure you're doing everything right." Corey was hiding under a table near the windows with his best friend Stephen Austin Eubanks, Jennifer Doyle, and Peter Ball when the shooters entered the library. While his friend Austin watched, Dylan Klebold aimed his semi-automatic at Corey and pulled the trigger, killing him almost instantly and injuring Jenny and Austin. Austin Eubanks later said about Corey, "People said he was the kind of guy people like to be around. I know I sure did. Corey was always able to pick our spirits up in a gloomy situation." Though Austin survived the attack, he sadly died from an accidental heroin overdose on May 18th, 2019. Just weeks after Columbine's 20th anniversary. He struggled with opioids for several years after the shooting, having gotten hooked on painkillers while recovering from his injuries. Corey was never far from his thoughts in life. He spoke about him often when he was at public speaking events. At first, there was an outpouring of flowers, notes, poems, ribbons, stuffed animals, pictures, and other objects that were brought to Clement Park to pay tribute to those that died, were injured, or just traumatized from the shooting. From that initial outpouring of emotions and disbelief came the concept of establishing a permanent public memorial near the high school. A memorial that would serve to honor those innocent victims, but also provide a historic record of this tragedy. The site of the Columbine Memorial was dedicated and opened to the public on September 21, 2007, to honor and remember the victims of the April 20, 1999 shootings at Columbine High School. Today, the Columbine Memorial stands as an open public place for all to visit and reflect on the impact and lessons learned from this tragedy. The Columbine Memorial Foundation is a nonprofit organization formed in March 2009 after the Columbine Memorial Committee completed construction of the memorial and disbanded. They accept donations to help with the upkeep of this memorial. If anyone would like to donate or visit their website, I provided a link in today's show notes. The Columbine Massacre had been so deadly that it is easily considered one of the most serious acts of terrorism on American soil. Combined with having happened in a high school, a place meant to symbolize youth and facilitate learning. The shock around the story remains over 20 years later. In total, all the weapons used that day were 4 guns, 7 knives, 2 large propane bombs, 7 smaller propane bombs, 48 carbon dioxide bombs, and 27 pipe bombs. In the wake of their aftermath, the lives of their victims and their families were shattered. But it wasn't only their victims who would suffer, as many Americans wondered how something so horrible could have happened at school on American soil. Those who helped Eric and Dylan acquire the guns were convicted, and the Harrises and Klebolds were hit with lawsuits. Robin Anderson, the 18-year-old girl who bought Eric and Dylan the shotguns, did not face charges in exchange for her complete cooperation. However, she could have faced charges if she would have purchased the guns from a federally licensed dealer. Mark Maines was a former Columbine student and friend of the killers. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison for selling the semi-automatic gun to Dylan Klebold. Mark was a computer systems administrator at the time of the incident, who surrendered to authorities in May and had pleaded guilty. He told the courtroom full of victims' families, "He was deeply sorry," and continued, "When I found out, I was horrified. I had no idea anything was going to happen. I told my parents, I never want to see a gun for the rest of my life. There is no way I can adequately explain my sorrow to the families of the victims of Columbine. It is something I will regret for the rest of my life." Another person who was sentenced was Philip Duran. A judge sentenced him to 4.5 years in prison for introducing the killers to Mark Maines. The prosecution argued that Philip not only knew he was helping Eric and Dylan illegally obtain the weapon, but he went shooting with them in the mountains and knew they had 2 illegally sawed-off shotguns. Yet Philip didn't turn the pair in, and all the weapons were later used in the Columbine Massacre. In April 2001, the families of more than 30 victims were given shares in a $2,538,000 settlement by the families of the perpetrators and the 2 men convicted of supplying the weapons used in the massacre. The Harrises and Klebolds contributed $1,568,000 to the settlement from their homeowners' policies. Mark Maines contributed $720,000 and Philip Duran contributed $250,000. The Harrises and Klebolds were ordered to guarantee an additional $32,000 to be available against any future claims. Maines was ordered to hold $80,000 and Duran was ordered to hold $50,000 in case of future claims. One family filed a $250 million lawsuit against the Harrises and Klebolds. in 1999 and did not accept the 2001 settlement terms. However, a judge ordered the family to accept a $366,000 settlement in June 2003. In August 2003, the families of five other victims received undisclosed settlements from the Harrises and Klebolds. Eric Harris's parents have mostly kept quiet after the incident and moved away from their home in Littleton, Colorado. The parents received a lot of backlash as the victims' families argued there was no way they could not have known of the problems their son had. Eric's father also kept a journal which detailed all of the run-ins with the law at school and with Brooks Brown. Eric had prior to the massacre. It was also reported that on the day of the massacre, Eric's father called authorities to state he believed his son was involved. After the shooting and before authorities found the killer's bodies, they searched the Harris household. The family had to be evacuated from their residence when they discovered Eric's arsenal of pipe bombs. Dylan Klebold's mother initially did not believe that her son had anything to do with the shooting and believed that her son was tricked by Eric into doing it. Her opinion changed once she saw the basement tapes. The basement tapes are probably the most notorious evidence collected by authorities in this case, but they are the least seen. It was roughly 4 hours of home videos of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold made in the last weeks of their lives. The footage was said to have offered a glimpse into the methods and motives into their actions. These tapes caused a lot of outcry because authorities destroyed them, deeming them as a particularly infectious form of toxic waste, a primer in mass murder that could inspire more violence and must never be released. Even with this explanation, many were angered by this announcement. They believed experts and researchers could have watched the tapes in order to understand and prevent these tragedies from occurring in the future. After Sue Klebold watched the tapes, she came to terms that her son was equally responsible for the actions that occurred that day. She also learned more about her son's mental state after reading his journals. Today, she has written books about her son's mental state, the warning signs she missed, and is an activist working to advocate mental health awareness and intervention. The Columbine Massacre has influenced several other school shootings in history, with many of the perpetrators referring to Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold as martyrs, heroes, or gods. In the 8 years following the Columbine incident, experts examined 12 major school shootings that occurred in the U.S. and found in 8 of the 12, the perpetrators made explicit reference to Harris and Klebold. They also found that numerous rampage shooters referred to Columbine as their inspiration, while others attempted to supersede the Columbine shootings by body count. This is a huge problem still occurring to this day, with more and more school shootings and plots being discovered. According to a 2004 investigation conducted by ABC News, they identified at least 17 attacks and another 36 alleged plots or serious threats against schools since the assault on Columbine that can be tied to the massacre. Their investigation showed that these attacks and plots were tied to the Columbine shooting as the perpetrators researched the incident, had clippings and images of Columbine, explicit statements of admiration for Eric and Dylan in the form of writings, journals, social media, in video posts, and in police interviews. 60 mass shootings have been carried out, where the perpetrators had made at least a single reference to Harris and Klebold. There are fandoms dedicated to these two, and there have been controversial video games made about their exploits, glorifying their disgusting actions. According to experts who have studied Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold's actions, the pair were undiagnosed and had deep psychological issues. Harris exhibited a pattern of grandiosity, contempt, and lack of empathy or remorse, distinctive traits of a psychopath that he concealed through deception. Dylan Klebold struck many as odd due to his shy nature, but he appeared to have had disturbed thought processes and constantly misused language in unusual ways evidenced by his journal. He appeared to be delusional, viewed himself as godlike, and wrote that he was made a human without the possibility of being human. He was also convinced that others hated him and felt like he was being conspired against, even though many reports say otherwise, that his family and friends loved him. There are a lot of questions that remain unanswered from this incident. This was a selfish and senseless act that has caused great pain for everyone involved. My heart goes out to the victims' families who have to carry this with them for the rest of their lives. So many innocent lives and dreams were crushed from two teenagers who wanted nothing more than to cause devastation for no reason other than to do it, which makes it that much more painful. What did you think of today's case? Let me know your thoughts in the comments. Don't forget to like and follow for more. Thank you for listening and your support. Stay safe, and I will see you for the next episode. Bye.